had the great pleasure of working with Michael Voss for the last 18 months to 2 years in a role which would probably be considered a mentoring coaching role. And it's the first time I got to know him. It's a funny thing in football, you can spend your life in the same world but almost can become parallel. And he reached out to me on the basis of really his own mindset as much as anything, that to have someone external to the football club, I suppose, that he could have important conversations with. And it ended up being a great year from a coaching sense to do that, because Carlton Football Club had quite a storied year last year, which he's the coach, including a period of time where they didn't look like winning and then a period of time where they didn't look like losing. And to actually see him and experience him as a leader during both of those phases and recognise and realise that I was getting the same person each time was certainly one of the revelations which come from it. The thing I really admire in Vossi is that he's got a very strong sense of and very strong belief system, particularly around competition and competitiveness. He's had a enormous amount of lived experience, both the highs and the lows, but you know, mostly the highs. Had a great career and captain premiership sides and now coaching. But he did also have the experience of being sacked as the coach of the club that he got to play in those three premierships with. And what you get from him is you get all aspects of that experience. You know, you get him the reflective person, you get him the grower, you get him the person who's got very strong beliefs but also recognises that he comes from a place of curiosity, but I also sense that he comes very much from a place of courage, the curiosity to learn and the courage to unlearn. So I think you'll get a lot of joy from this hour and a half or so that we get to spend together and as Michael Voss talks about his life in the arena. So I have Michael Voss and we've got to know each other pretty well over the last 18 months, which has been terrific. The name of the podcast is In the Arena. So when I think of In the Arena and you, I think of you, the 14, 15, 16-year-old, where that seemed somehow destiny for you and you were introduced to it at a very young age. What are your reflections on that time now?
Such a long time ago. Feels like a completely different person in some ways. Yeah, it does. It feels like a long time ago, yet the memories are really front of mind. Had fond memories of growing up at Morningside Football Club and my dad being the president and everything else that goes with being part of a local community football club and spending time with my brother, kicking the footy out the front while we waited for dad to finish work. And so some really fond memories there. And then also coming through the pathways at those particular times as well and stepping our way through that. And Queensland was such a far different place to what it is now when it comes to access to the AFL.
But you're in an AFL club pretty early, aren't you? And it was the Brisbane Bears. And in some ways, almost my reflection is they wouldn't have quite felt like an AFL club at that point. If you were moving into, say, an Essendon or a Carlton or a Collingwood of that era. But you came in Brisbane Bears. And I had a conversation with Shane O'Sullivan recently about it, and I think Robert Walls was the coach.
Yes.
Walls was the coach, yeah. And he said there was almost the first training session you come to and you're running back with the flight of the ball or something like that as a 16-year-old or 16-year-old-ish, and you took the mark and did whatever you did. And Shano said it was destiny. He said it was destiny. Did it feel like that for you?
No, it didn't. I was probably really unaware of perhaps my talent at the time. Most people who tell the stories and reflect back on those stories are almost like, I wish you told me. The only time I really thought, geez, I'm half a chance here was at the Morningside Football Club and I had a ball in my hands as I normally do and it's pretty sort of old leather and that I had been mucking around with the ball and I was watching the senior game being played. It was Morningside versus Southport and Ian Stewart was standing on the seat. I remember it like it was yesterday. And
Triple Brownlow medalist
Ian Stewart. And he tapped me on the shoulder. I played with his son, Ben, or against Ben, his son. And he tapped me on the shoulder and he said, son, if you don't play AFL football, I'm going to come chase you. And I walked away and
it could be a bit intimidating too.
Yeah, Stewart. And I knew who it was. And yeah. I rushed out to Dad and I found Dad straight away. I said, Dad, you never guess what Ian Stewart just told me. And he goes, well, maybe one day, son, maybe one day. But I think my home environment was, pretty level towards it. Like I never felt like I was treated extra special, and the conversation around the dinner table was never about playing AFL football. I had a very strong vision about what I wanted to do and what I wanted to get after, but there was no real conversations that if you do this, you can be this. It was just none of that. So I just went about my business. In some ways, that was a good thing. The realisation of AFL football and how big it actually was and the difference between playing for the Brisbane Bears versus Essendon probably came home after I won the Brownlow Medal and obviously shared that with James Hurd. And spending my week in Melbourne and seeing the adulation that came towards James Hurd and sort of my relatively, what I would say, unknown about me, or at least that's what it felt, and watching him and how he was adored and put on a pedestal, I sort of thought, wow, that's different. It's the first time I'd actually really sort of seen that. And, Queensland was far from that at that particular time.
Which is amazing because you're playing in the same competition. You're doing the same things. And Brisbane was starting to show some good signs as well and your fame within it. At what point do you think, well, the role I now play in the team, because the individual success came for you, so that was about, what, 4 years into your career? How old were you?
Yeah,
were you
so
when
I was 21 when I won the Brownlow.
Yeah. So at what point does, because the ultimate accolade in the game in terms of particularly external expectations, at what point does it shift for you where it becomes from you to team in that sense in a real way? Does it, because just making it, I assume, regular game, I'm in the side, and that happened relatively early for you, to that little switch over where you say, no, it's actually more than me.
Yeah. It's
or was that always natural? Was that a natural?
No, it wasn't. There's probably stages in your own development, and again, sort of reflecting on, really key moments that sort of felt like I was making progress. Was the first one came in sort of starting the 95 season and a pre-season game. I was playing a little bit more midfield and I transitioned from playing halfback to wing to then going on ball. And after one of the pre-season games, Wolsey again tapped me on the shoulder and he sort of goes, mate, you're ready. You're ready to go. And to get that from Wolsey, like to understand the concept of 2 years of being bashed around the ears and trying to earn respect from this man, because he was really hard, expected you to be extremely professional. Work ethic was a really key value of his, and so him to say you're ready to go, that was a great moment for me.
What do you think he meant by ready to go? Was as
it was almost like the sign of like you can play midfield now, right. Like you're sort of ready for AFL football, and we're going to let you go. And 95, I won the best and fairest at 20 years of age. So that was, that was quite a significant achievement. Again, sort of all trying to take it in my stride somewhat. And then I think you go about trying to then form your own identity around your role and how you grow within your own team. And I guess the second significant moment came was after the Brownlow and then being named the captain of the team at 21 years of age.
Co-captain initially?
Co-captain initially with Alistair Lynch. And yeah. And again, that became as a byproduct of a conversation with John Northey at the time. Wolsey'd obviously moved on, and Swoop said, "Look, we want you to be the co-captain. We feel like we've got this strong group of players, peers in the same age that need to have that representation and should be captain." I initially had said that I don't think I'm ready for that particular responsibility, and I had a conversation with Chris Scott. And the conversation with Chris Scott effectively went along the lines of, mate, we need you and, we need you to represent us.
So Chris as a fellow young player.
As a fellow young player with the same age.
He'd won the Rising Star as well. So, there was a reputation beyond the team.
Absolutely.
For Scotty.
Yeah, and so we had Justin Lepich, Nigel Lappin, Jason Akamaz, Clark Keating, Chris Johnson. Chris Johnson hadn't arrived at that particular time. He's just about arrived. But that was our core nucleus. And then we had this sort of older group that I couldn't possibly sit in a room and give feedback to about how to play AFL football. That was not my role. But what I could lead by was example and work ethic and show them a new way, if you want to call it that. And So I tried to let my probably more competitive drive take over in my leadership at that time.
Was that a conscious thing?
That was a conscious thing, absolutely a conscious thing. Because I'm thinking, I'm asking, you know, am I going to lead at 21 years of age? I can't go and tell, you know, the guys that have played 200 games of AFL football how to kick it, how to play, be tougher. It just wasn't going to be my thing. I'd played in the vicinity of 75 AFL games. You know, I was lucky I'd achieved some personal milestone. I was respected in the team, hopefully for what I stood for, but you know, as you can imagine, there's a lot of insecurity and a lot of imposter syndrome going on at that particular time. So, and then I guess when we went through that short period of time as my identity started to grow within that role, you know, Swoop had left, the club had blown up and Lee Matthews stepped in. And I think once Lee had stepped in, that transition going from it's about me and how good a player I can be, the realization that for to be able to go to the next step, it wasn't going to be about how I influenced the game. It was how I was going to influence others to be able to influence the game and get more people in on this journey. So if you wanted to look at it selfishly, I needed others to make me better.
So how did that transition happen though for you? Because you still, I know you also had a serious injury during that little transition as well. And the history also was that Brisbane went to the bottom of the ladder, having all this talent, all this expectation on them. And I think it's 98, isn't it? I think they finish on the bottom of the ladder. I think they're probably the most talented team ever to finish on the bottom of the ladder, and there's always reasons for that. So there was, and then you've got, you know, almost a messiah figure coming into the club in Lee Matthews. What, and I love the fact you've gone straight to this idea of identity, and I know you talk of that now as a coach. But in you and defining your own at that time, was that just something you were doing the work on, or was it something you were getting supported to understand? Was there any sort of lessons learnt that you realised that, you know, what's actually got you here won't get you there type stuff? Was there any of those things happening, or was it just your own self-work that you were doing?
Well, I think it's a collision of events. You know, the events that you talk about or the moments you talk about was – you know, I broke my leg. I'm sitting in a hospital bed.
And badly, wasn't it?
It was a
bit career-defining.
Very career-defining moment for me. While I was in hospital and while I had a broken leg, our club was imploding. I had the president on my, you know, at the end of my bed asking me whether we should keep our coach or not. I said, that's not my decision to make. That's your decision to make. Now, subsequently, you know, while I was in Perth, head coach gets sacked. While I'm in Perth, board members walk out, and I'm the captain of the football club with my leg up. Amazing. And I'm thinking,
at what age were you?
I was 20. I must have been about 20, 22 or 23 at that particular time. You know, the club was seen as, you know, we weren't quite as professional as we needed to be. We felt like we lacked a lot of resources that we needed to be a professional or at least take the next step as a football team. So it was a collision of all those events. But all those moments, all those sort of moments that I've had, they've sort of stepped me to the next level. Yeah. And through reflection and trying to work out where I wanted to go next and what was going to be my next goal. And I think intention is actually really, really important because, you know, the intention had shifted to me and it was more about all about team goals. It was not one individual goal in amongst those goals. I used to have a heap of individual things that I wanted to still get better at. But I shifted it slightly just to go, well, the only success that I want to have is all around team. And how do we get the team to where we need to go? How do we get the club to where we need to go? And I think that just slight shift of intention actually shifted my whole focus about what I need to be better. So all of a sudden it was more about how do I make my teammates better, not how do I make me better, and how do I get their involvements up, not my involvements up. And that slight shift in intention, I think, really helped me. Now in hindsight, I didn't know that at the time, but now in hindsight I look back and think maybe that was probably the most important thing that had actually transpired for me.
And that was during a time where even having to play again was an issue too, wasn't it?
Like you, absolutely.
Yeah. You would have had that fear
sitting
there for you. How fearful were you about that?
Oh, very. I mean, I spent the next I spent the next 18 months really struggling to get up from game to game, to the point where I wasn't.
Because of the pain?
Because of the pain, yeah.
Yeah.
I still had a rod in my leg, which was causing some issues. Now, I was playing, but I was not the best version of myself. But I was able to manage that, and we had a very successful season through 1999. We still finished in the prelim final. I missed out. I had an injury at the prelim final, so I didn't get to play it. So there was sort of build up of all those particular moments, but at the same time, I sort of look at those and don't regret any of them. They're all in the makeup of who I am, and sort of through the things that were thrown at me, hopefully, you know, that gets all tipped into the pile and the melting pot, and out pops a hopefully a better version. And so that sort of helped me through the periods where we were really successful, and through our periods of 01 and 03, 04. So that's the sort of journey. I've had a series, I guess, of events over the course of my career that have sort of led me to the next stage, and they've sort of led me to the next stage, and I've been okay to sit within that.
Did they lead you, or did you allow them to be the lessons? Like you mentioned the word reflection before, and even as a young person, it sounds like you were actually writing individual goals down, or you're having an expectation of you in regard to that.
Yep.
Was that something which was there, always there for you?
Naturally, I've always been hardwired into that. If I set myself onto something, I can get after it. I probably learnt over a period of time that most of it was set because I would dissect it and I would work the problem. Mm-hmm. And I'd work the problem by myself.
On your own.
On my own.
Yeah.
And what I've learned over time is that working the problem with others actually can sometimes come out with an unexpected version and probably a better one in many instances. And you're still really strong on your own value sets. You're still strong on the direction. But I think when you can remain open and curious, I've learned open and curious. I was more stubborn and more competitive, and I know what it takes to win, and let me at it and I'll be the difference. Whereas I've learned over time, leadership isn't about being the difference. It's about being able to sort of bring a group of people along with you, and that's the difference. Mm. And so that's taken a long time to learn, a lot of trial and error. But I guess individually how I've grown is taking that real individual approach to it and then sort of starting to move it towards how do I make this more collaborative?
Yes. And it sounds like some of the lessons which came your way, or the things that shaped you, and the people who in one way or another found their way into your world, was there, how much of that was people almost saying, Vossie, mate, you're going to have to move, or your reflection on, I need to move myself here?
Mm, that's a good question. Yeah, I couldn't actually answer that with any real certainty. I think there's been both, and I've needed both. Sometimes it's been all about the you need to move, and getting the firm this is not good enough sort of message. And then there's been ones that have just been so obvious and just so in your face that, you know, you've been able to sort of move yourself.
Yes.
And I think the one that I'm referring to, and you talked about those events of 1998, I didn't need anyone to tell me where we need to go next. That was just such a really profound moment in my life about, and a real sliding door moment about where we need to go next. And I had 7 days when I was in that bed, and I'm just thinking about all the things that had happened and all the things I wanted to be. And one thing I am very, I think, quite good at is that once I've shifted my mind forward, I'm going forward. I don't look back too much. And there's a strength and weakness in that too, by the way. But once I've set, I'm going there. I can move on very, very quickly from where I am.
Yeah,
and even
yeah.
when I'm lying in the bed and I've got my leg up and I've got a broken leg,
yeah.
I can put it in its place and say, okay, what does this mean? And then I can move pretty quickly forward.
Yeah, so there's not a lot of grieving by the sounds of it.
I don't grieve too much on those sorts of things. Right. I can live with the fact, well, okay, it's happened, and how do I actually move on?
No, that's powerful. So tell me about the weakness in that, when you say just...
Well, the weaknesses of that is sometimes to being able to stop and smell the roses. And,
right.
And sometimes, you know, the acknowledgement of how far you've come,
yeah,
and it's taking for a moment to be able to celebrate that. And so within, I'm okay within my own world around that because, you know, I'm in my own skin and I can sort of live with that. But it's very important to be able, as a coach, to be able to stop and step back and acknowledge how far people have come, to acknowledge how far they've got to go, and be able to stop and be impressed by even the simple things, and be able to just acknowledge those simple things, reward those simple things, celebrate the little things that are actually happening. And that's not been a strength of mine in the past, because once I've achieved it, I move to the next thing. And so I'm looking for the next big goal. I'm looking for the next big thing that we need to be able to go after. So I've learned that over time, that as a leader, it might not always seem to be impressive in your own world, but you've got to stop and acknowledge it because it's important in somebody else's world. And that's what I've got more perspective around.
That's very interesting, because one of the most motivating factors, I think, for all of us is a sense of progress, as in we're making progress here.
Absolutely.
And if, as a coach or a leader, you're not actually providing that sense of progress, as in it's all about the next thing, whereas if you're particularly with a young athlete or a young player or anyone, one of your coaches in your team, you say, look, what I see in you now is this. What I saw in you a year ago was this, and that represents great progress for you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if we're always thinking about the next thing, progress becomes almost irrelevant in its own way, because we're only worried about what's next. And it is and particularly in a very dynamic environment where the measurements are so precise in so many ways, but so imprecise in other ways, that we can actually lose that sense of where we've come from, where we're going, and how important that growth is, and how motivating that can actually be for the individual.
Yep.
And if you're not thinking like that, you know, you could lose the room.
Absolutely. There's joy in the process. And you know, I love that Simon Sinek, joy is not in the comparison, it's in the advancement.
Yes.
And I think what he's talking about there is, okay, let's not compare ourselves to others. We're comparing us against us and finding our own best version, our own PB. And that's really important. So we're trying to find everybody's own PB.
Mm.
Is important, because then we're sort of measuring against themselves as much as we need them to move and shift and get better. And but we've got to move the individual to get better. And you know, the advancement is about that celebration of the journey, about being able to love that process, about walking in every day and saying, today I get better, and what am I going to get better at, and loving that. And that is one thing that I did love as a player. I loved getting better. You know, I love walking into the gym and lifting heavier. I love running. I love going out for a run and running faster. I love going out and trying to learn how to kick better. I think that was what I hope was sort of separated me from most, not from all, from most, was that when I turned up to train, I trained to get better. I didn't just turn up to train. And there's a big difference in that.
No, there is. Is there a danger of perfectionism inside that?
I was never a perfectionist.
Is that
never
right?
A perfectionist.
Yeah. I wouldn't have picked that.
Yeah,
I would have thought there was always that element of just pure detail in the way that you go about things.
No, it's more about being driven. Right. It was more the drive.
So progress versus perfection.
Yeah. It was always about that. I was never too worried about mistakes. I could move on from pretty quick. I could put it in its place and move on. You know, the other thing I think that was probably more a challenge for me was the like versus respected. And, you know, so seeing or making a mistake or, you know, staying safe for the interests of being liked was never something that I was...
As a captain or as a coach or as a person?
Yeah, as a captain or and a person, probably more speaks to the person than what it was necessarily as the captain. But the shift in me came from, in myself, came when I moved that I don't want to be liked, I actually want to be respected. So my approach to the way that I played changed. So I was more confrontational. And so you learn, well, what's my edge? What do I bring to the table? I don't run the fastest. I'm there a bit, you know, I'm okay, but I don't run the fastest. I'm not the most powerful. You know, I don't run the furthest in our team. I'm not the best kick in our team. But what I am is confrontational. And, you know, both from a physical and mental standpoint. So that to me was going to be my difference. Now to do that, that's not an easy step to make, because what you've got to move past is being liked. So as a captain, was sort of saying, you are my mates, but I've got to lead you and be able to have those peer conversations that are not necessarily that comfortable. And, you know, I think as a leader, that's one of the biggest challenges, is that sometimes you've got to be the biggest fool in the room, right? And sometimes you've got to say the thing that nobody else wants to say, and that's uncomfortable. But that's, you know, sometimes you've got to make the decision that's not liked, but it has to be respected in the end.
I wonder whether there's actually a little level beyond your the respect piece, which I agree with, by the way, is my sense of you is it's to be trusted. You know, to be trusted with the responsibility of leadership, to be trusted that if you have some feedback for the person, that it's coming from a good place. Because you can be respected and like and still say something not, you know, which is but you're coming from a place of, I'm giving this to you because I think it is actually genuinely what you need to hear and what we need from you, even as captain. And the transition from the 21-year-old version of you to the stage where you can actually do that, it's a very short period of time in a, even in the male developmental perspective, you know, you're still a young person at that stage. We'd often get reminded that the male brain doesn't kick in until it's about 25. You know, so, and I'm sure you're dealing with that from on a day-by-day basis now. But to actually get to the point where you say, yeah, I understand the difference between liked and respected, and there's a cost associated with leadership, isn't there, in that way?
Absolutely.
That there'll be there could be a relationship damaged as part of this. And I've often thought about, say, you and a group of people who by situation and circumstance have a lot of them gone on and coached. You know, you played with a number of people who have been now coaching in the AFL or have coached in the AFL. How much of that was sort of nature and nurture, if you like, from the environment that you would have played a role in creating, do you think?
Well, the environment's everything. That's first and foremost. How we create it, the environment. I mean, that's really, as a leader, what our job is to do, is to be able to sort of create that environment. We create the right environment, then that let the talent flourish, and so they'll bring their natural flair and what they bring. But
and you were aware of that even at that age?
Absolutely, absolutely. It was about creating environment. So I always take the standpoint, it's like if you're in the trenches with someone and you're coming from a place of investment in that person, and you're not just investing in football career, but they're investing in them as a person, there's no bad conversation to have. Because it's always coming from a great place. And so
that's really interesting.
So for me,
there's no doubt for you in that situation. Having to question yourself. I know this is coming from a good place. There's no selfishness.
I'm not questioning my intention. There's no hidden agenda.
There's humility in it.
I have no other motive other than how do I make you better?
Yeah.
And in turn, what makes us better? So I think that's a really important distinction. Is that, you know, if you're in the trenches with someone and you're really sort of invested in them as people, you know, like I always use the analogy, it's like I'm coaching the person, I'll get a better player. Like that's just the, you know, I just believe in that.
Mm. Did you believe in that even as a captain, do you think, or did that penny have to drop for you?
No, the penny dropped. That penny had to drop. You know, like you go from I reckon as a player you're very selfish. Like athletes are very selfish.
Yeah.
You know, like I talk about this in my home life, and everything that we do, we go barbecue. Do we not go to a barbecue? You know, who's there, who's not there? You know, that whole sort of world is like surrounded by you. What do we eat? Where do we go out? Who are the friends we mix with? Like it's sort of quite a selfish existence. Yeah. It's a selfish existence, and you sort of have to be a little bit like that.
You've almost got an excuse to be that way as well.
Shouldn't.
Yeah, but it could easily be that, couldn't you? I need to do this because where really the because mightn't be a because.
Yes.
Yeah, it's an excuse.
So I think you've got to shift there. I don't think anyone naturally sort of arrives there. There might be some exclusions to that, but generally I think no one necessarily arrives there.
Yeah,
I think that's sort of something you figure out as you go. But also I think certainly as a captain, and maybe I'm slightly different as a coach, I have very high standards. And so when I played – I would hold my opponents to those very high standards.
your opponents?
I would hire my opponents to those very high standards. So in turn, if I was having those conversations to my opponents by getting in their head around what those standards actually were, then I absolutely had to have investment from my teammates.
So tell me, explain that one a little bit more to me. I don't think I've ever heard that before.
Well,
it might be a unique Michael Voss.
Well, no, the psychological banter that right. I would try to find the flaw, the self-doubt. I was always looking for that in my opponents, and I was always looking for that little bit of self-doubt, maybe that little bit of a trigger that was a self-talk that I could trigger in their own heads that maybe put some seed of doubt in their own minds about themselves or about their own teammates or about how they were playing or about the moment and whether they were ready for it. So that's the way that I approach things. So
that's classic in the arena stuff.
That's in the arena yeah. because that's delving into what's under the surface. It's not dealing with what's above the surface. I was looking for what was below the surface and trying to find those threads and pick at them.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. So as you can imagine, when you're sort of having that approach to your opponents, then you better make sure that your own teammates are living up to those standards as well. So I was, you know, probably deemed ruthless at times to my own teammates to ensure that we live to the really high standards. That didn't mean we met them all the time, but they had to be in absolute no doubt what I expected of them. And, you know, but it wasn't – here's the important part. It wasn't done in a demonstrative way. It was done in a coaching way, in a supportive way, in a nurturing way at times. Being able to find the time to be really direct and pointed, but then be able to step back and coach and support and be able to nurture – That's a really important thing. It's not just, you know, deliver it and live with it. It's like deliver what you need to be able to do, but then how do I support that? How do I give you better capacity? How do I help you be able to get through that moment? So if you take those things together and treat them together, how can they not take on that feedback?
Yeah.
If you're not just giving it to them, but you're supporting them and you're coaching them and you're helping them build capacity, I think that's what your responsibility as a leader to do.
And would you consciously then cycle back? So something happens in the moment, say game day or whatever.
Yep.
And like if you're in the middle of a game and obviously there's a scoreboard, there's the winning, the losing, the moment happening, but there might be two or three things which happen in a game as the captain. You say, well, I better cycle back to that person. I said something to them, you know, during the course of the game. Or, you know, how conscious of that were you even as a player back in that time?
No, very conscious of it. The large driver was, do you have the capability right now to do that? And if my expectations were that you have the capacity to be able to do that, I was pretty blunt.
Mm.
Because this is not a capacity gap here.
No.
If there was a younger player...
When you say capacity as in your right to say it or...
No, more so that they have the capability to execute.
I see, yeah.
And so they have the skill sets, but they choose not to.
Yeah.
So that... Whereas there's very different to... younger teammates that are just forging their own way and being able to provide a different level of feedback and a different level of support because there is a capability gap.
Yeah.
So the way you approach it to me is very, very different. One, I have an expectation because you've shown you can do it and you've let yourself down there or you've let us down. Or second, if you don't quite yet have that capability to be able to do that, well, I'll still give you the feedback, but I'll also support you to be able to sort of build what you need to be able to do that better next time.
To understand the gap and
understand the gap.
How we go about filling it in that sense. And how much did that then play into your coaching because you take that on at a very young age?
Yeah, the way I described the coaching journey for me was almost loop right back to the start of my playing career, where right. It was more about, I think it was started to become about me as the leader and the difference I could make versus what we could make. And that's where I've really shifted from probably being at Brisbane and then being here at Carlton is that there is way too much emphasis. Leadership is obviously critical. It can't be understated. But the real thing I've probably more appreciated over time was that it takes a group of people to be able to create the shift. Or create the coaching or create the environment that we're after. And I'm sure you'll probably delve into that. But there was very much a coaching and me focus versus a coaching and we focus from where I probably shifted from my original lesson. So it almost like I looped back to the start of this player where it was about me and how good I wanted to be and what I wanted to achieve. And then it shifts very much to, you know what, I'm here for a greater purpose, you know, like I'm here for the Carlton Football Club. We're creating a transformation. We're trying to create a more sustained level of excellence that we perhaps haven't had for a very, very long time.
No, that's a really interesting insight, because it seems to me there's a hero's journey version of this. You know, you achieve something really early in your career. You have the disappointments. Those disappointments help feed the next phase of it, and you have the success of captaining, you know, three premierships in a row. You know, one of the great teams of all time. But then you become the coach at a young age. It's almost like you had to go through the hero's journey all over again. You know, it doesn't build on as much of the learning, perhaps, as it could have.
Oh, it's a different skill set. It's completely different skill set. So you almost have everything's no choice. About through others.
Yeah.
Everything is about through others.
Yeah. So the selfish sort of playing element of it can't sort of be there for you, even though there's clearly a spotlight on you.
Yes.
You know, and it would be so easy for that. I can see that actually almost happening. And it's interesting because I don't know if you can remember, I actually rang you during that period of time to see if you're interested and it was whether you're going to coach or not. And it wasn't, it was almost as though there was opportunities being thrown at you at a time where probably a part of you understood that you weren't fully ready for it. It's probably the 21-year-old captain all over again in some ways. But it's the opportunity to coach your own team and coach your club in that situation.
And which is different, and being offered roles.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was, you know.
You're not being interviewed.
I wasn't being interviewed. I was being offered roles.
Yeah.
And that's a very unique thing. Now, I look back at that now and I go, how did I just not think that was unique? Like that was – maybe the time was different, I'm not sure, but it was a very unique. I look back at that now, like, was I crazy?
No, it was, but
that's what was unique about it.
Yeah, I wasn't offered. I was young CEO at Richmond. I wasn't interviewed. I was just offered the job.
Yeah,
I'm not sure what they knew what they were getting. Yeah. to be honest, yeah. I think they understood the pedigree.
Yeah,
and in your case, there was clearly the pedigree, but I'm not sure if they understood the essence, you know, they probably did in some ways, but they didn't, you know, could you lead an organisation in the way that you're being asked to lead an organisation, which wasn't about your physicality and your playing talent and all these other elements of it. So it's almost like it's almost even the interview process itself perhaps would have washed out at least a few of the things that you then needed to be more aware of. Or was there anyone who was helping you through that period in terms of your transition into that role?
No, that was the version that was the competitive driven, I can do this and I'll solve the problem by myself.
Wow.
it wasn't the collaborative.
So the eyes rolled back.
And the eye, you know, and, you know, I guess I sort of had thought I'd pick my journey. And maybe just sort of stepping back for a bit and trying to work out where I wanted to go next and just taking a breath would have been the smartest thing to do. Getting swept up in the discussion and the talk and could I or couldn't I was could I? Could I actually do this? And maybe I can, because I've been told often enough that I probably could. So no doubt there was some element of being swept up in that conversation. And the more I almost try to step away from it, the more I almost got sucked into it.
That's interesting.
And so there was a lot of things that I learned about that. And I look back at that time and the perception of me at that particular time I felt was all wrong, but at the same time somewhat right. So to sort of sit back and sort of go, well, okay, that is what it is. Again, I don't look back at it as a time that I regret. I look at it, but that was just another makeup of just who I am today and the lessons that I've learned. And I needed almost that experience to arrive where I am now.
Mm.
And without those lessons, I don't probably apply my own leadership principles that I feel like will help me today and keep serving me well today.
Mm.
But at times it was a pretty harsh lesson to
learn. Oh, no, it was the most intense. And it's interesting because my recollection of the conversation we had, which wasn't a lengthy one or what, was that you sounded like a player. You didn't sound
it's a great way of looking at it.
You didn't sound like a coach.
Yeah, the player coach.
Yeah.
Versus the coach.
And it was almost like you were being swept up a little bit because I think media offers were coming your way. There was probably a lot of things, opportunities, which were presenting themselves to you, which offered, you know, very different things. Like, because once you're coaching, you're all in, as you know. If you go into the media, you're on the periphery but enjoying it, and there's other elements to it. But my sense was, because of who you were, that if we were to appoint you at that time, knowing we would just you would find your way as a coach.
Mm.
We would have that confidence in you, and it would have been the support which you needed to require. But it sounds like you mightn't have made yourself too available to that.
No, and that's the critical thing. The only places I'm left to wonder whether it could have been different was with the right resources. You know, could have it worked. But I think as a club, and clubs are very different now, I think, the way that they look at things. But it's a little bit along the lines also as like, well, we have to also have an acceptance of failure here because the guy's still learning.
Mm.
And he's still on this new leadership journey. And I talk about a lot about this. Playing and coaching, they're completely different skill sets. You know, having the knowledge of playing and having the technical ability of being able to play, I was in somewhat of an advantage position because I was a leader or a captain of a football club. But being a captain of a football club and being coach of a football club, they are very different skill sets. They have the same principles, but the stakes are higher. They're much, much higher, and your reach is much further. And the things you sort of thought you knew as a captain, you certainly very much learn very quickly as a coach, and it's very different. So I treated the coaching journey that it was a completely different skill set.
Did you think that initially, or was that something?
No, I did. I absolutely did because, you know, I'd invested in myself for 2 or 3 years, you know, around, you know, leadership and life coaching and sort of trying to invest a little bit around my own personal development in this space is what's the actual structure of coaching? What's the structure of communication? You know, how do we ask better questions? So I was doing that while I was playing and then obviously picked up the pace when I'd finished and my couple of years in media, but that didn't necessarily make me experienced. And a lot of the decisions I make today have been why they're easier to make is because they come from a place of wisdom and they come from a place of experience, and you've got, you know, if you draw 2 + 2, you probably know where you're going to end up. You don't know exactly where you're going to end up. You sort of go, well, if I take that and that, it's probably going to equal that. So it's whereas when you're starting out, you don't have those. You don't have those benchmarks. You don't have those flags in the ground. You don't have those reference points. You're building your reference points, which is why experience is so important. Now, I learnt my craft on the run. A lot get to learn their craft in the background and watching others do it, and whether what they do is right or what they do is wrong and how they would put their own flavour on it. But I felt like I had a pretty strong mentor in Lee Matthews as a bit of a guide. And I do wonder if there was things that were different, could have been different. But I wasn't ready. The organisation wasn't ready, and I'm okay with that, and I sit okay with that.
No, it's interesting because the conditions we create as leaders is ultimately what the role expects of us, but even in the senior role that you have, you need to have conditions created for you in that sense. You know, it's not – no one does it alone, as we know, as much as they're – an interesting thing I find even for, say, senior coaches, CEOs, you're still only ever a role player, you know.
Yep.
In that sense, even though the light which is shining on you is clearly very bright, but if you just don't fundamentally play your role, and you can't play your role as it relates to what this group, these people need from you, well, you're not going to succeed, and there's almost no chance of that. And so, you know, you've taken on at that stage, at a very young age, still forming. It's interesting that you actually, even towards the end of your career, were putting yourself into a place of learning in a quite structured way by the sounds of it. Mm-hmm. And again, my sense of you is that you don't see growth as a project. You see it as a process. You see it as an ongoing thing that you're just going to continue to
I'm
do.
I'm a lifelong learner.
Yeah.
I've always.
Where does that come from, do you think?
I'm really not sure because I wasn't great at school, so it didn't come from school. That's for sure.
Were you a learner as in you didn't want to learn algebra, but were you someone who was curious, or you were around in that environment, just that the environment didn't suit you, or that you just had no appetite for learning?
It wasn't my passion. It wasn't the learning. I sort of learned to love learning when I finished school, not when I was at school. I loved the whole school experience, but I didn't, the learning part, I could have sort of taken a leave. It was about footy and sport and getting out at lunchtime and having a ball. That's what I wanted. So I learned learning. I think if I really had to sort of really delve into where learning and my passion for learning come from was this just seems like a strange place to where it's actually come from, but I'm naturally just a competitive person, which means when you're competitive, that's changed for me in its meaning. As a player, competition was about winning and losing. As a coach, it's about finding the best version of yourself. And so compete has a different meaning for me. It's so as a coach, I feel like that's what I'm constantly trying to invest in, is like, how do I get better? And the way I get better is picking up a book and listening to a podcast and learning how to coach more and go visit overseas and go...
Putting yourself in conversation would be...
Putting you in conversation.
Yeah, I just noticed how you operate in that sense, that you are a very... I've mentioned this to you before. You're very present in conversation with people. Like, you're very present now. Whereas it'd be very easy for you to be thinking, oh, gee, I've got... I'm coaching Carlton. I've got all this stuff to go off to. But you're not. You're present. You're here. You're in this moment. And your capacity to do that is, I think it's a bit of your secret sauce at coaching.
Well, maybe it might come from my dad. I was thinking as you were sharing that, my dad was always like, we're a bit more into a football club and the regulars that were at the bar, and, we probably affectionately know them as the bar flies. And he said, you never know what they're going to come up with. Just listen to them.
Yeah.
And just listen to them, because they might come up with a profound bit of wisdom for you. And so... I think presence is part about staying curious and being open, and that's the one thing I've always been. I don't think I've ever really been ever a closed shop. I've got firm views. I think every leader has a firm view. We've got firm philosophy on. But that doesn't mean we can't open up and stimulate the environment with some conversation, and it never hurts anyone to have a different point of view at the table and to consider it and be open to it. And so when I'm around people, I feel like there's always something new to learn. There's always something new to be open to. I think that's a really important part, is to be where you are. And I talk to players all the time, keep your mind where your feet are. And that's a really important skill set to be able to have. And in an industry which is trying to take you forever forward and forever back, there could be not a more important skill to learn.
Mm. When did that penny drop for you?
I'm not sure when it dropped, but it became even more probably profound was last year.
Yeah.
And
talk me through that.
Well, when you've got so much commentary around you about what you should do, there's never been a moment where you've ever been reinforced around knowing your philosophy and understanding what your philosophy is and backing that in. And Pete Carroll talks a lot about this. He talks about the understanding of self as a leader and understanding your own philosophies as a leader. And it's interesting when you go to every leadership thing you ever go to, it always starts on self. And sometimes I look at that and go, oh, this is a bit of a boring conversation. We're starting self again. Like, I want to get to the better stuff.
What's the better stuff for you?
Well, I don't know. Like, it could be about leadership and about strategy, or it could be about decision making or adapting in, environments. So, this real more of the most dynamic space. And yet the fundamentals are still the most important part, and understanding yourself and exploring self and how you think is exceptionally important. And why? Because in those moments when everyone's got a view on how you should do things, you've got to come back to that. And every person that sent me a message, they'd say, "Boss, you mate, just stick to what you believe in. Do it your way." Well, what is your way? If you don't know what your way is, then how do you stick to it? And this, you can't become a chameleon as a leader. You can't be a pleaser to all. It's got to be, no, this is the way we're going to do it. We will open up conversation. We need to be really clear on what we're not prepared to change and what we are okay to change. And so that evolution of you as a team is important. The evolution of you as a leader is important. We're never a closed shop. We're always evolving. Your identity is not set. It is evolving. And what's important to you is always evolving. So you have to be open enough to that. But when you've got 1,500 media and this saturation of social media and you've got all these people in your team listening to all of that, as a leader, you need to walk in there going, right, how's he going to go here?
Yeah, you're on show. You've got to show up.
You're on show, and they want to know. I want to know you believe, and if you believe, and you show that in a lot of different ways. You show that in how stressful you are. Like one of the most important questions that we went through: what type of leader do I want to be today?
Yes,
and writing that down every day for 8 weeks straight, and going, okay, today I want to be calm. Right, what does calm look like? Today I want to be composed. Today I want to have interactions with my relationships and turn up the same way every single day, knowing that there's this storm on the outside. I think that's a really difficult thing to learn. And where does it come from? It comes off knowing yourself. And we just don't spend enough time as leaders being able to invest the time in understanding yourself. And it seems like a really simple thing to say, but it actually has a really profound effect when the storm is surrounding you.
Because that's when leadership's needed as well. Absolutely. That's when it's most required.
But it's also acknowledging, I couldn't change it myself.
Yeah.
So, what I've learned over time is that once the thing's in motion, you're not the one that's standing there sort of trying to push it by yourself. Like you need a whole bunch of pushes. And sometimes when the wheel is rolling, all you're doing is just holding it.
Yeah.
All you're doing is trying to stop the momentum. And so if you can hold it for a little while and then you get enough people in behind it, then the wheel will start to turn back the other way. And so that's investing time with my captain and Patrick Cripps. That's the outstanding leadership of, you know, having a Luke Sayers or a Brian Cook within the organisation, because in those moments it takes clubs to make that movement. It doesn't take necessarily one person. And that's where leadership does stand out, is when you've got that collective that are in behind that movement. You can shift it. You might be there for a little bit, but you won't be there for a long time.
No, it's a really interesting phase, and I'm glad you've actually gone there with it, because the word you used was wisdom, the wisdom which comes from it, and the fact that you've actually looked at, you know, one of your most fundamental beliefs, it seems, is the idea of competitiveness, you know, but you've actually reflected on what competitiveness is as you, how old are you now?
Yeah, 48.
48. 48.
I didn't think about that.
For yeah, you did. Yeah. You covered some ground in your 48 years, I've got to say. I want to work through what I'd consider like a very real leadership scenario for you. Your first year back at Carlton, it's really quite positive. Like you miss out on the finals very disappointingly in the end, but it's the best season Carlton have had for some period of time. Expectations coming into the season. Start okay. You weren't playing great, but you're actually, the scoreboard was sort of 50-50-ish at that time. And you go through a run of losses at that time. With each week, it just builds, I assume. What's happening for you as it builds? What's it like to be you, the leader, in that moment?
Oh, it's there's a lot going on.
In your mind or around you?
Lots in your mind. I remember waking up one morning and sort of, you know, my wife giving me the rally speech and saying this is the week, and for the not the first time, but it was sort of the more what I was feeling was like, oh, this is not turning overnight. Like that. There was some deep-seated confidence issues that were emerging within the team, and normally I'm always quite optimistic as a leader that, you know, the next next week will be the next win and that'll be the shift that'll happen and we'll be right. But I really felt that this was far deeper. And it was built off some expectations and we were sort of going into a direction or a hole that I didn't like. And so I thought, we're going to have to dig here. We're going to have to dig for a little while before we find our way out the other end. So trying to still navigate what was important, but importantly, an opportunity probably to strip back a bit and go back to, okay, well, what are the little things we need to be able to get right? How do we provide just absolute clarity to everyone about what needs to happen next? And it didn't need to be complex. It needed to be really simple. So how did we do that? So
is that what you mean when you say you didn't like? You felt that – what was the bit you didn't like?
Oh, there was more the confidence of the players. Yeah. The confidence of the players was diving. And you could see it. You could see it in the way they were playing. And the expectations they had on themselves, the joy we're having in our environment, the commentary that was on the outside, you could see that that was a load that was getting heavy. So I guess it was trying to provide the simplicity, going back over the things that we said we wanted our environment to, what it needed to look like, and being really consistent with it and being clear on what we needed to adjust or alter and what we needed to keep exactly the same without all the noise going on. So that was probably difficult trying to manage all that and knowing that there's obviously a greater conversation that's going on around you. I felt the most important thing for me as a leader at that particular time was more that question I posed a little bit earlier around, well, what type of leader do I want to be able to be today? That put the ball in my court. It was, I wasn't going to, what could I control? I could control what leader I needed to be, who I was going to influence on the day, what was the energy I wanted to bring into the place. And so I just became fixated on getting that done.
So how do you get that done?
Every single day.
So is that like pen on paper? Is that
pen on paper? I mean, I journal a lot more now through trying to do that practice. I write. I don't do it on a computer. I have an iPad that I do it on. I like to write, so it's an important part of the week, or even at the start of the day, or even at the end of the day, to be able to write down what I felt like was going right and what wasn't going right. So it just didn't look like it was all in one pile. It was like, no, this thing's going okay and there's things that aren't. So what do we need to get after? What do we need to continue to reinforce? So it was just a lot of conversations. I felt like it was really important as a coaching group that were on the same page. Spent a lot of time in the match committee room talking about what it was going to look like, how did we want it to look, what picture were we going to be able to put. So that were complex conversations. But then the important part when we walked out of those complex conversations was it was simple. And so when we walked into the players, it was like, guys, this is what it is and this is what we're going to get after. It wasn't the total problem. It wasn't the total solution, but it was part of the solution. It was the part that they could implement. It wasn't the part that was so complex that they just couldn't get their own heads around it. So that was an important part. And knowing that leaders were also an important part of the journey, at no point did my leadership group not accept accountability for where they were.
So the player leadership
group? Player leadership group.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that had been a shift from previous time, but every conversation I have with them, they're going, this is on us. We're going to get this done. This is on us. This is going to done. Give us the clarity we need and then we're going to go and action it. That was great. There was no blame. There was no pushing to somebody else. There was no, below the line sort of type behaviours. There were some things we needed to tidy up and there's some tough conversations we needed to have. And they were done at a player level that needed to be done. They were done at a staff level and needed to be able to done. We had timely conversations. We didn't let things lie. We didn't kick it down the road and say, we'll have that conversation tomorrow. We're going to have that conversation today. So we tried to problem solve all those things, and rather than let it fester and sweep it under the rug and let's deal with it a different time, we dealt with it in the moment, at the time. So I felt like all those little things, and I'm washing over a lot of others, contributed to try and help us be able to work our way through that. And there is no doubt that having a leadership that was adamant that we were staying the course helped be able to keep everybody calm.
So beyond
in what
you,
we're doing.
So the people who were going to influence beyond you,
yes,
as in, you know, the trust of you by president, CEO, those sorts of people who are, you know, highly experienced people. What sort of conversations you were having with those guys during that period?
I was talking to Luke every single week. And
so
Brian,
Luke
says
the president, yes. Brian Cook, the CEO.
Every single week. And we're just trying to solve the problem together.
They were the conversations. So it wasn't just you saying this is what you're trying to do. Were you actually receiving input from them?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of questions. That sort of probably shows the difference to me at the start to the end, because I would try to solve that problem by myself. And I would have tried to come up with the answer by myself. But I think there's something as a leader when you show vulnerability as a leader and you're actually open to, you know, having advice and being mentored through things. And what I found, like Cookie and Luke were very good. They're good asking questions.
Yes.
And they weren't necessarily sort of, they were saying stuff, but they weren't saying stuff. It was, you know, they were asking me questions constantly, not in a so much a challenge way, be able to, you know, probably mentor my way through it. And for me to be able to, on their wisdom, they're great leaders. So they've got great wisdom. So I was trying to lean on their wisdom about where we need to be able to go next. I was leaning on the wisdom of our coaching group and the skill sets that they had and the capacity that they brought to the table. And together we were going to solve that problem. I was going to solve that problem by myself. I could execute it, my role in it. So what is the role hold of me right now? Well, I could execute my role, but I needed everybody else to play their role as well. So that's what I mean by probably holding the wheel versus moving the wheel. Mm. And, you know, I feel like the problem was solved together and then we were able to action that and then we got the movement we're after. But, you know, that change didn't happen in the second quarter because we kicked 8 goals and now we arrived. I mean, that happened because there was – that environment was built over 18 months. That's the change that existed. That's the transformation that was taking place in behind the scenes. That was the things that were happening behind the scenes that no one was seeing. The end output was not going our way. The end outcome that people were watching on the weekend wasn't going our way. But there was a lot of other little things that were. And so we probably paid more attention to those little things than necessarily what the scoreboard was telling us at that time. And that was, we weren't ignoring it. It was real. It's real feedback. We weren't on track. But what we paid more attention to was, are we creating the space for this to happen? And we need to tidy some things up. And then that quarter comes and then the momentum we were able to transfer. But it wasn't just because we kicked 8 goals in the second quarter or 9 goals, whatever it was in the second quarter of the Gold Coast game.
Well, the 8 goals doesn't come unless you're doing that work.
Correct.
Yeah. So yes. It becomes it's an interesting one of the frames, and we talked a bit about it at the time, was this idea of data, dialogue, decision. So what's a data? The data we've got is, it's good, but it's never going to tell the whole story. So, and one of the data pieces you're dealing with at that time is a scoreboard, and the MCG's got a big fucking scoreboard.
Yeah.
So it's a very defined piece of data. The score shows that we lost. And so that the expectation is we win. So the data, but there's a whole lot of other pieces of data which clearly you're taking in. And the data is in statistical data. It's data through your observations of behaviours. It's all forms of data at that time. And then you mentioned the conversations you're having. So the dialogue in and around what the data is actually giving us and our own observations. And all of this is coming from a place of uncertainty, of ambiguity, of being questioned, of members microwaving their membership tickets, whatever's going on at the time, you waking up to your own sort of your own, you know, thinking, gee, am I on track here or not? Because that's the natural aspect of this. And then we have to make a decision. And the decision is to stay the course because we have trust in what's actually got us to this point.
Mm.
At what point do you say, hang on, we mightn't be right here? This
I actually never considered that as a
yeah
as a question. And the reason why I hadn't considered that as a question was because I felt quite sound in what we're trying to do. And all the things that we take metrics behind the scenes on were going well. If those metrics were way off.
Yeah, so that data was actually relative. That was saying you're on track.
We're on track. Yeah. And I don't mean game day metrics. I mean just like the how's our environment look? You know, we take surveys of our environment about players. Like this is real data. So it's not like we're sort of, you know, it's superficial and we think it's going okay. It's real data. You know, our training data that we take. And it goes deeper than GPS numbers. You know, we go deeper than that. And these are all the things that you pay attention to see whether you're on track or off track. But there's some things we clearly need to pay attention to and we need to be able to clean up.
Clean up in the way you play or clean up in just
some... Oh, there were some changes we need to make in the way we were playing.
Yeah,
okay. Just, you know, when you looked at the way
game style,
we were playing. Yeah, we needed to just to tidy up some things. So there was some attention to things that we needed to get after. So there was lessons learned out of that. But there's even little challenge points around how hard you go even at press conferences, you know, like... You know, and this is where you get challenged as a leader because I felt at that particular time it was really important to support the players and it was really important to show belief in the playing group. Yet the commentary was around, well, when's Michael Voss going to show up? Sorry to refer myself as in third person, but when's that competitive, hard-nosed, you know, put your head over it, coach going to come out?
We want to see some anger. We want to see the eyes roll back a bit.
Well, there's a moment for that.
Yeah.
And then there's a moment for this. And at that particular time, it was paramount that with everyone judging them, why did I need to judge them? Why did I need to give you easy fodder and be able to go after my players even more because of what I said in a press conference?
Mm.
That's not the real me. I don't do that.
That's not leadership for
a start. That's not leadership to me. We need support. We need to help each other. We need to be able to more nurture. That does not mean that there were not accountable conversations going on behind the scenes. That does not mean that there was not tough conversations that need to be had. Tough conversations don't come because I'm sitting in front of 15 media and I need to tell the world that I'm having conversations. I don't believe in that. That's more about you as the leader.
Did you ever feel like that? Did you ever at different times when you were like you thought, gee, I've just seen a performance which was clearly below our expectations?
Yeah, I do. But I think it's like the question you got: who am I serving? Am I serving me or am I serving my players? You know, like, and if you come from a place that where you're serving others, you need to ask the question: well, do they need this? Like, not do I need this? It's like, do they need this? Do they need the accountable conversation? Do they need the upfront tell everybody that, you know, we're having these types of conversations? Or don't they? And so from the outside, it's around belief and about backing people in. It's about seeing brilliance in them when they don't see it in themselves. And sometimes the leader have to do that. Well, you know, often with talent, it seems obvious, you know, like that they should have this self-confidence and self-driven, but the reality is we all have our self-doubts.
No.
And in moments where it's not going so well, we rid ourselves with self-doubt, we rid ourselves with self-talk. So what you need is somebody who believes in you.
Mm.
You know, it might not necessarily be the head coach, but it might be an assistant coach. It might not be the assistant coach. It might be the head of high performance. Someone needs to believe in me and they need to see something in me that maybe right now I'm not seeing in myself. And as a leader, you know, at times you have to show that. It's not just, like you said, oh, now I believe in you. It's like, well, no, I believe in you. I believe you can do this. And it's challenging them to be able to get outside of their comfort zone, to be able to find their better version of themselves. And then when they get there, it's like you see them believe in themselves. That's one of the most rewarding things you can ever have as a coach is when they have the realization themselves that it's like, hey, I can actually do this. And like, there's no better moment in coaching than when someone actually does that, and
is
they're
it number
able to
one?
Navigate tough.
Like, is the whole idea of belief the number one thing that we're seeking here? Like, as in
belief and trust.
Yeah,
those are two things.
Yeah, you know. So then they're pretty related, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
They might
be. Yeah.
Yeah. And so even that concept, and I reckon I love the just a little simple measure. Do you believe in your people? Do they believe in you?
Yep.
You know, if you – and trust probably is the outcome of that piece, because you might trust them, they don't trust you.
Yep.
It could be – it could – that is possible.
Well, I'll give you an example. Like the – to – one of the things that after when I was coaching at Brisbane, I read a book because this concept around trust kept coming up.
Mm.
And it was like everybody was talking about trust. Whenever we did a session and we put the sticky notes on the table, we made some notes, we wrote letters, this word trust kept coming up. And so I'm like, I've got to investigate trust, like, because the curiosity in me was killing me. Mm. So I went and sort of started to investigate it, and I read a book by Stephen Covey, The Speed of Trust. And great book, one of the best books that I've actually read. The unexpected thing I got out of it was, here I was thinking about how we can build trust in others, but it was actually, how do they trust me? So as a leader, what was I doing that was showing I don't trust? And there was things that I was doing, like, for example, I would show non-negotiable behaviors within the team meeting, and I'd show them, I'd make examples of them, but I'd still pick the same person. And I keep picking them, and they weren't doing it, and I'd pick them. I'd pick them again. And so I'd imagine as a player, they're sitting there going, what do I trust you for?
Yeah.
You know, and so you lose that little bit of trust. And there was some examples of that I sort of felt like. It was like that I started at that point. It was like, no, hang on, how do they trust me? Forget about me trusting them at the moment. I need them to trust me. And there were some things that I wasn't doing that I needed to be able to show that, and that I believed in that.
Mm.
It was very important.
So how important was that period for you? We've sort of brushed over it a little bit, because you finish up at Brisbane, but then you actually go into the world of coaching from the almost like at the most, well, it's an assistant coaching role effectively. And I know the role actually emerged and grew for you in at Port Adelaide. How important is that period for you?
Port Adelaide?
Yeah.
Really important, because I had to go back and work on my craft.
Yeah.
There was not just that, it was the technical craft. And I was really lucky. I had a great mentor with Ken, and Ken's, you know, he'll challenge the best. Yeah, Ken Hinckley, and you know, he's more than happy to have the challenge conversation. But you know, as he said in the early days, it's, you know, he would challenge in slightly different ways. It's like, well, you know, you can test a ball, but can you teach it?
Mm.
You know, and can you inspire people to want to do what you did? That's the art of coaching. You know, the challenge points come even when you're coming as assistant coach and you're sort of coordinating training, and, you know, rather than you buy the guy up the front, you know, he'd pose a question, well, how do you do that without taking one drill? It's like, that's hard. Like, how do I do it at the same standard? You're asking me to do the training environment at the same standard without me taking one drill. So it meant then spending more time with coaches and, you know, how they saw the world and how they would do that drill and the standard they would do it to. And that's trust. That's showing them, you know, and giving people autonomy, if you want to call it that, in their role. Their independence, probably more so than autonomy. Because autonomy means you've got no – I think sometimes autonomy means you've got no accountability. There's accountability behind it.
Yeah,
there's
a balance.
All those little lessons, you know, I was not that at Brisbane. I did everything. I controlled everything. I wanted to have my finger on the pulse. And I don't know why I was like that now in reflection, because it's not necessarily how I'm hardwired. But it was an important lesson for me that when it came into the Carlton job was we were well-resourced. We had the right coaching group around us. I could spend time with the players. The coaches led the environment. They the ones up the front. I was the one at the back. And so it became more of a team approach, and that to me is an important part of establishing trust. And I think when you can model that as a leader, then they can't help but take that on, because that's essentially the environment that you're leading.
Was it the goal through that period to coach again?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah,
because I feel like I've raised competitive a few times here today, but the competitor in me.
Yeah, I'm glad you have, because you've actually reinterpreted it about three times. So, like, often even when I talk, people say, "Well, what's your purpose?" And I go, "Oh, no, I want to know what your beliefs are."
Yeah,
because there's a good chance your purpose will emerge from you. So, this idea of competitiveness is clearly a embedded belief you have, And then you try to create a purpose which relates to that belief in one way or another. Your purpose even as a player was to compete in the way that you physically had the opportunity to doing, but then you transitioned that into a leadership and in various ways. You then get to coach to that. You then get to assistant coach to that because the first go at coaching doesn't work out perhaps as it could have, and then you get to do it again. So they're almost different interpretations of the same belief, if you like. So I'm glad it's actually really come up because even in with the leadership work I now do with CEOs, everyone wants to talk about purpose and vision and all. Okay, I just want to know the stuff you believe. What do you actually believe
well,
in?
Well, my purpose is courage to always compete. Like that's the – and the courage, again, is a very different meaning to player to –
That's great.
To being a leader.
So it's almost like a trademark for
that's
you.
That's my trademark. And the trademark is courage to make the decision. Like courage as a player was go back and fly the ball, run when no one else was running, train harder than anybody else. Now I've reinterpreted that. And so for me now it's about courage to make decisions, courage to always turn up, courage to be yourself. So that's taken different meaning. The compete I've already talked about, which is around the difference between competition. And what I struggled with when I was going through that journey of who am I, compete and courage came up a lot. And I'm like, oh, yeah, but compete, how does that sit with me? So how is that as a coach versus a player? So I had to sort of conceptualize that a little bit and I had to put a few things on paper. And then once I'd sort of rationalized it and put some deeper meaning in behind it, it sat really comfortably with me. Like I now know what it means. Like, so the competitor sometimes you can take and it's like he's driven, he's single-minded and, that's one part of compete. But there's another part as well. So the competitor in me did say, I can be better. I can be better. And it took me a while. Like the journey with the Port Adelaide, my start was very different to, probably towards the end. We came in when they were preliminary finals and then we sort of drifted out of the finals and so I came in 2015 and then sort of we had to rebrand ourselves again and we changed a couple of times in our game model. Our list was evolving. Seeing Ken as a leader through that particular period of time and observing him, how he was handling that was important because it had a contrast to the way I probably would have handled it in some instances. So it was just nice to be able to get that contrast and to be able to see that. But also what Ken was very good at was he gave me space to be able to do what I wanted to do and he backed it in for better or for worse, but he would challenge it constantly behind the scenes and the accountable conversations that had. He never shirked any of those conversations. It was between the eyes at times, but he also gave you the space to be able to create your own area, flourish your own area. So I was really thankful for that experience that I had. I had a fantastic group of people at that particular club and forever grateful for the exposure they gave me through that period of time.
And it sounds like it's informed you a lot in regard to your approach. So when you get the opportunity to go to Carlton, you are pretty clear as to what the model looks like for you. We've talked about this a lot in the past, but the idea of mechanics and dynamics, you've got a good sense of what mechanics you want to create in order to get the dynamics to enable you to do that. The interesting thing is that it seems that when you are losing the games, you still stay with the mechanics but realise the dynamics need a little bit of tweaking perhaps, a little bit of mechanics in the way you're playing, and I get that. But the danger is you flip the mechanics around and the dynamics are given no chance, whereas you almost your responsive nature, particularly when you're being told that it's not working by a lot of people, that you actually want to change the mechanic of the thing. We were playing this way, we now play that way. We did train this way, we're now training that way. We used to have our meetings this way, we're now having them that way. The concept of holding that line, there's one of the things that I often think about is that there's noise in and around the game. There always will be because of the huge interest in it. Almost differentiate when it becomes almost like a racket, where it's almost like it feels like it's conspiring. It's more than just sort of white noise around you. You start to see agendas emerge where Michael Voss's failure as a coach is a much bigger story than your success as a coach in that way. and sometimes it can seem and people almost creating a self-fulfilling, you know, they're, you know, you missed out at Brisbane and you're going to miss out again at Carlton. How aware of you of that type of thing happening?
Well, I think we had a conversation. I'd actually love the analogy. It's, you know, the media don't barrack for Carlton. They barrack for the story. And that really resonated with me. I've never really felt a need to have people think good of me. Like I don't need the outside component to know what I'm doing well or not doing well. I just don't need that. What's important though, and I think this is even in good times and in bad, is that what I was determined to do was that I was not going to be influenced in my decision making by what someone else said. I wanted to have a clear set of eyes, and every time I looked at someone or I made a decision at match committee, it wasn't because the fan base liked someone or didn't like someone. It wasn't going to be because the media were on him or wasn't on him. I wasn't going to treat someone different because someone felt like they should have been in the team or not in the team. I just wanted to walk in every single day and just like, oh, I am going to look at the behaviours they bring, where they're at, and then value the information that I'm getting from the inside and from the people that should know. And it doesn't mean we ignore everything. We take as much information as we can. But at the same time, just have a clear set of eyes so I could make the best decisions. And that was important to me, was because making one decision after the next decision after the next decision, I think is where sort of Cookie sort of says, you know, it's a bunch of great decisions. You know, to be able to get to where you need to go, it's a bunch of great decisions.
Yeah, whereas the world might judge it that on the basis of one decision.
Yeah.
You know, like for instance, the Carlton turnaround is actually people are looking for
the silver bullet.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. And
they're looking for the reason.
Yeah.
It's like, well, I don't have one for you because it doesn't work like that.
No.
It's all a bunch of little things that add up over a period of time. It's like how we found ourselves not in a great spot. There's a bunch of little things that happen over a period of time. And sometimes you're trying to find out what lever is actually going to have the most profound effect. But I've just learned over time it's not one particular lever. Every now and then you might just get that lucky one. Mm. You might. But my experience in high performance is it's just one after the other, after the other, after the other. It's when we rush. It's when we become impatient. It's when we pull the trigger before we should. You know, that there's some of those decisions. Then there's some decisions you wait too long. And you just got it, and you've waited way too long, and you go, geez, I wish I made that 3 weeks ago. And I didn't have the courage to be able to make that decision. Well, only you know that as a leader. You go, well, I should have made that decision 3 weeks ago, and I didn't do that. That's on me.
That's an interesting call, because often you are the only person who knows that.
Yes.
You know, it might have been a little standard you walked past, it might have been a little expectation which wasn't met, and you in observation of it only know yourself because you're the person setting the standards,
yeah.
You know, and often. Yeah, even in ideas around bravery, people can judge you on those things, but only you can really judge you in that way. I could have gone there, I didn't go there. Yeah.
But look, this might be diverting a little bit off what you were talking about, and we talk about where we are and what we're trying to achieve. What's very important in cultural change, transformational change, is who owns it?
Hmm.
Well, is it only just me?
No.
Well, we all own it. We all own the way we play. So if we all own the way we play, then we've got to formulate the way we play all together. It's not just me that's going as a lead. I'm helping, guiding, nudge, challenge. When we talk about standards and walking into, you know, Carlton, clearly the standard was nowhere near good enough. Now, I could come in and go, this is the standard, or we could work that together and we could determine what that standard actually needs to look like. And then as a leader, I'll nudge that and I'll push that and I'll challenge that.
Talk to that a little bit. How did you actually set the standard?
Well, the big one for us was almost like that whole gap analysis is around, well, what would we like it to look like? So what is elite? What is elite standards, basically? So what's a 5 out of 5? Where are we now? So based on what you've observed, what you've seen over the last little period of time, where are we now? So that might be your 2 out of 10. Well, how do we bridge that gap and start going after it? So do we all agree that this is the direction we need to go in? Now, there isn't a person that'll keep that hand down and go, no, I don't want to go in that direction.
Yeah, that's right.
They'll put their hand up and they'll say, that's the direction I want to go in. And so once you've decided the direction we're going in, you know, I've got to hold you accountable to that.
Yeah.
But I just don't own that. It's leaders own that. The playing group own that. So when we're having conversations around the direction we're going and where we're at, they're easier conversations because we all bought into this. We all said that this is what we were going to value. And sometimes we just need to be clearer about what that actually looks like and challenge what their view of it is versus what my view of it might look like. And you sometimes have those gaps. So in the point throughout that time where you are challenged, that was a lot of the conversations. How do you see it? How do I see it? What you deem is acceptable is not what I deem to be acceptable. And I need to show and be really clear about what that actually standard actually looks like.
That's mostly behaviours, is that?
A lot of behaviours about what we value within the way we were playing and where we need to prioritise our efforts. And, you know, a lot of guys talk about, you know, the camp and when they went away and they had the conversation. Well, the fundamental question that I asked Cripper to come back with, mate, was what are you going to be committed to? What do you want to be known for? Like, forget what I've said. Forget what's been said before. Come back with that one answer. And that sort of led into then a commitment around their defense and their contest. And
but that, now, that wasn't a because, new conversation.
No, that wasn't a conversation. That was not a new conversation because that had been challenged on every level and it was being said time and time again. But again, until we get to the point where the group sees that as the main priority and that's the main commitment, then this needle is not going to shift. So that was taken on to their credit, accepted full accountability for it, and they went to work on it and they actioned it and they drove it and they monitored it. And so if there was a silver bullet, that might have been somewhere close to it. But
it sounds more like a tipping point than a silver
point. Probably more a tipping point within it. So that was sort of how it is. But again, stem back from the Gold Coast to then pre. Well, the environment says that we own this together. We design the program together. We have a schedule together. Now, what my job is to work out then what has presence and what doesn't have presence and what's important. Because the reality is, let's face it, if we all just did what everyone else thought, we'd have a whole bunch of ideas and there'd be a lot of activity, but there wouldn't be a lot of purpose behind it.
No, it could lose its way in about a second. Yeah. And it's interesting how you get then others to buy in on this, because you could have well-meaning people, you know, one out and one back from the playing group who may in their own way be compromising those standards and expectations.
Yes. Yep.
So your idea of drawing others into, like if you're president, your CEO and your other, but you know, you can't have the sort of soft ear. And unfortunately, I've been in environments where, you know, we were trying to build that, but we didn't get the buy-in from everyone else to say, actually, that compromises. I know it's well-intentioned, but it's in fact compromising.
Yep.
Yeah, particularly big clubs, I think, particularly the case in regard to it. I'm interested on standard setting. Do you set the standard or does the competition set the standard?
It's a great question. Great question. So if one of the really big things I think is important to understand, like there's a saying that I go with, it's more about what we become more than what we achieve. And the become to me is a bit more of the higher purpose. And so as a result of that, to me, the become part is about setting your own standard. We know in the competition where we are that the benchmark is set from, you know, the premiers or the team that's been sustainably being paying at the next. But I'd like to think we're sort of constantly looking to find our own PB and we constantly challenge what it actually looks like. And so with that become part is around sort of saying, well, what's our standard? The standard is our competition. So our own standard is the competition. So how do we keep challenging ourselves to be better? Because we know if we're better, and there's some confidence. I say that with some confidence, knowing that we have some talent there that can do something pretty special. But at the same time, it keeps us quite present to what we get to control. And we're quite present that we get the chance to be able to move that needle. And it's not determined by anybody else. It's not determined by Collingwood or Geelong or anyone else. This gets determined by us.
That's good.
So we try to drive that standard based on that. And then when we have that breakthrough and we sort of draw a new line, well, we're looking for a new line. We mark the line and we nudge it even more. And hopefully then that becomes – the standard? So it's a great question, because the immediate instinct is sort of say within the competition we have is we have a ladder, so it's very easy to measure because we go there's the top and there's the bottom. But I'd like to think that we can think past the achievement. We can think beyond that. And we've got to think about excellence and sustainability. And to have sustainability and excellence, you've got to keep challenging your own standard. So that's what I'd like to think we're going after.
And someone's trying to unravel you every week as well. You're playing against someone who their objective is to...
Yeah. That doesn't mean you don't have strategy. That doesn't mean you don't have tactical.
Yeah,
it doesn't mean you don't have all those. Yeah, yeah. It doesn't mean that tactics don't play a part. But you've got to also be very firm on where you're going and the way you want to play and what's your environment look like. And look, I just think every team has its own personality. You know, we acknowledge our past, we acknowledge our history, we're very proud of that at the Carlton Football Club. It's got a very rich and deep history, probably one of the richest and one of the deepest in the competition. But we're not trying to be... We're trying to grab out the great parts of Carlton and the DNA of Carlton, the rich parts of Carlton. We're trying to put it into our environment. We're not trying to be Carlton in the 60s. We're not trying to be Carlton in the 80s. That was their team, their personality, their characteristics. We're trying to be our version. We're trying to bring our flavour. We're trying to bring our own story. We're trying to tell our story. We're trying to create moments. Mm-hmm. We're trying to tell those moments. We're trying to reinforce those beliefs. And that's what we've got to keep. And we're trying to define those great moments when we play against Melbourne and it's in a final and we play out that last minute and 10 seconds and we want to celebrate what that actually looks like, because, you know, that's
it's a new moment. It's a new one.
It's now. A new moment. Mm. It's ours, and we're not trying to compare it to anybody else. We're not trying to compare it to the 60s and 70s. We're trying to compare it against us. So that's where we've probably found our joy, is trying to be able to challenge what that looks like for us.
No, it's a really interesting point, because we've all got a so far story, and a lot of this conversation has been about your so far story, and probably for the last 20 minutes about the not yet story in so many ways. You create the conditions for an unknown and unknowable future. We don't know what that's actually going to be for us. So the only thing we can sort of create is our us story, or our self story, or our now story in regard to that. And you know, the wonderful thing about, you know, an organisation like Carlton is there's been young men at the peak of their lives, now young women at the peak of their physical life, wearing this navy blue jumper with a white monogram on the front and trying to do the best for themselves and each other during that period of time. That was the thing which the success would have been defined by. But it's a different form of that now. So what defined the success of the great teams of the past won't define the success here.
Yep.
But there's a lovely sense of pride that you walk past 16 Premiership Cups when you know,
absolutely,
when you walk in the place, and your own version of that. But at the same time, it can become a burden. It's almost like you're carrying the frustrations of generations of, you know, in probably the last 20 or so years.
All I can do is, we've felt that. Mm. I've felt that when I walk through the door.
Yeah.
But I can't understand that. I can only appreciate it.
Yeah.
But it's not my job to carry it.
No.
So it's not my job to carry that weight. My job is to be able to get out there and sort of, that's why, you know, come as a coach with a new set of eyes and a new way of being able to look at things. And if I walked in feeling like that was on my shoulders straight away, I don't think we'd get the change that we needed to get, because then I'm making decisions in retrospect versus what actually needs to be made. And that's, to me, the courage. The courage is to make the decisions you need to make in the best interests of the football club.
Mm.
And sometimes that is liked and sometimes it is not. It's making decisions on players that are well-loved players, but it's helped us get to ninth.
Mm.
So, well, that's not the goal. The goal is to be better than that. So, you know, so we can get hampered by, oh, yeah, we want the change, but not if it means him.
Mm.
Mm. So, you know, we want the change.
Because I love him. He's my hero.
I love him.
I've got his number on my back, yeah.
But we're ninth.
Yeah.
So when do we start to move past this? When do we start to actually make decisions based on the best interests of the team and the direction of the team and where we want to go? And that was some tough early conversations and getting used to this notion that, you know, we're not relying on our heroes to make this movement. You know, like we're not putting people on pedestals here. We got to value and give status to role players in this football team. The people who are able to get up and get that done, yes, we have the stars. Yes, they'll play well and they have the talent. But we've got to stop putting this on a pedestal And we've got to start to actually normalise this a little bit more, and let's have some level in and some consistency in our day-to-day environment, not this emotional sort of roller coaster of winning and doom and gloom when you lose and this euphoria when we win. It doesn't work like that. How do you establish consistency over 23 weeks if all you do is ride the emotional highs and lows of wins and losses? Well, we'll let our supporters ride that journey, but we're not riding that journey. So that's why I mean we can't carry the weight, because if we did, we'd carry it every single week, whether we win or we lose, and that's not how you go about your daily training environment.
Yeah, and you're carrying enough weight as it is. Like, it's not...
We don't need to, but we don't step away from it as well. Like, we embrace it. We think we're privileged to be able to have that sort of level of exposure, and having that conversation is not a burden. It's a privilege.
So you have empathy for the experience of your supporters,
absolutely,
and the fact that we respect the fact that you probably love us more than you love just about anything else in your life. Then that's a wonderful thing that we get to actually almost experience. But we're the current incarnation of that.
Yes,
we're the modern version of that, and we're measured by what we do with that now. But gee, we love it when the crowd's roaring and
no more magical moments.
Yeah,
right?
And I think you expressed that really well last year. You sort of embraced that in its own way, without it actually ever seeming like it was a distraction.
Mm.
Because that was probably your first experience of that real big club sort of mindset of 90 to 100,000 people at the MCG moments, which were particularly the Melbourne game, where it actually for all bar about 2 seconds of it, you thought you were going to lose.
Yeah.
in so many ways, it was just one of those games.
Yeah, and again, maybe that's part of my past experience, is that being in Brisbane, we had none of that.
Yeah.
And in some ways you actually like that, and there's other parts you just go, geez, I would have loved to have had that. I digress for a second, but one of the conversations I had with my wife, Donna, through the period of time is we're going through the tough patch. You guys, remember you asked for this.
Yeah.
And it was such a really lovely reminder that I'd worked really tirelessly for 8 years to just get another opportunity.
To be in the arena.
Yeah. And sometimes, that comes with where you can dread that. But you got to remind yourself, I love this. I actually, in the end of the day, before a game, that feeling you have when you don't know what's going to happen, and the unease that you have around it, that's why I got back in. So otherwise I would just stay in the media and I wouldn't have had that feeling of, are we going to win or we lose? Because I don't care. Whereas when you're standing there in the arena and you've got something on the line and you can win or you can lose, that's what draws me back. And so... having that feeling of being able to pre-game and see our supporters and see the crowd fill up and the MCG and there's another 86,000 people, almost sit there and just go, take it in and just look around and just go, how good's this? How good is this? I wouldn't be anywhere else now.
I'm so pleased to do that, because it's so easy to make that clinical, isn't it? It's so easy for you to go, almost give yourself a sense of privilege, if you like. Whereas if you just go, no, I'm going to honour this. I'm honouring these 86,000 by trying to create something which will bring a form of joy, which will be as much joy as a lot of people get to have in their day, their week, their month, their year, their whatever it might be. And those sorts of moments. And that's...
Sorry, can I digress this while you interrupt? One of the great conversations in the last 6 months, which is completely unexpected, was that I've got, parents that are coming up to me and that have been lifelong Carlton supporters for such a period of time. And they come and they go, I get to take my kids to the footy now.
Yeah.
And they get to see us win. And they get to see, what their environment's like. They get to feel Carlton, and...
You've reminded Carlton of what Carlton is.
It's magic.
Yeah.
How is that not magic? Like, that's just brilliant. And so we talk a lot about that next generation, the influence we get to be able to have. And... that's when it becomes profound to me. When it comes profound to me is you can forget there's sort of like, we've had 20 years where we haven't been, winning as much as what we should. And my kids, they have not seen us play a final.
Mm.
And I go, oh, wow, that's when it sits back to me, the significance of it all, is that now the kids are coming, they're coming as families, they're with their mum and dad, and they come to the footy and they're joining our community, and it's very family orientated, and it's a safe place that everyone can, you know, show their true passion. And that's the origins of, you know, football to me, of sport, bringing communities together, bringing families together, being able to follow something you're all passionate about. In the end, that's how I grew up. I grew up with those origins, and that's what I love about our game. But to see those real stories, that was really fulfilling. If there was a fulfillment in what we did last year, that was the fulfillment. The fulfillment was being able to see that. And hopefully, it guarantees nothing. Like, we still sit here and we're early parts of the season, and yet it still guarantees nothing.
No, it doesn't. It's all... But it's. I think if I was a Carlton person, I'd love the fact my coach thinks like that and feels like that, because it is easy to get very clinical about it, because there's aspects of it which are purely clinical. And there is also, and you and I have shared this idea of where we've all got a because story. We're here because. But your because story is the young kid who loved the sport for what you fell in love with the game when you probably had no choice, because you got a before story, Morningside, or, you know, whatever it might be, your dad and the barflies, I think you described it as. Yeah. And then we've got some beyond story, some place we'd like to go, which is premierships, it's success, it's all those sorts of things. But the only way we actually give ourselves any chance of achieving that is if we stay in a place of belief and we create a sense of belonging. And so the belief and the belonging isn't just you and your team, it is the mum and dad taking their sons and daughters to the games, because they believe and they belong as well. And we've got to have deep respect for that, because that's with them a whole lot longer than it's with us.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be part of you forever, no doubt, but it is their identity when they probably had no choice in life, like you had no choice in life. You know, they were probably given a footy club before they were given a name in some cases, you know. But in utero, they were Carlton supporters, you know. That's the power of it. And in our own way, we sort of got to represent that. And it's amazing how, even though you might grow up with a certain club, how you'd absolutely fall in love with – I grew up as a Richmond person.
Yeah.
We hated Carlton's guts. You know, that's actually was part of it. But here I am, you know, watching Richmond versus Carlton the other day, you know, in the crowd, and a little fist pump, you know, when you got up in a tight game. It's just amazing how it becomes then a part of you. And Carlton's a big part of you now.
Massive part. I mean, it's sort of, you talk about reignited the love of the game. I grew up a Carlton supporter. The 80s are not unfamiliar to me, and it's hard not to draw back memories of sitting beside my pop, who was the only other Carlton supporter. Otherwise, they were all other Richmond.
Yeah, is that right?
So most of my family are Richmond supporters. My dad certainly was, but my pop was the Carlton supporter. Now, I don't know how I end up being the Carlton supporter, but clearly I love my pop, and, you know, we had some great times together, and we watched footy together, and remember those sort of magical moments in that magical era. So to sort of almost go full circle on that, and then be able to sort of end up as their coach. So the story's not complete. There's still more to tell, but at the same time, you know, I don't think there's anything wrong with being able to just sort of sit back at different times and just be able to sort of acknowledge where you are, and to use your point earlier around present, just be totally present to where you actually are.
Well, mate, it's been a pleasure talking to you. We talk all day.
Thanks, Robbie.
I reckon. Thanks very much for the opportunity of sort of visiting your experience in the arena. It's I've loved the opportunity of just getting to know you over the last 18 months, and again, the one thing which I think is your presence and your generosity are two things which I think of often, and I reckon all of that's come across in this conversation. So thanks very much for the chat.
Appreciate the chat.